Good morning and welcome into the show. It is Daniel Wertman coming to you live from the Dreamaginate Sports Studios. It is 8 a.m. on the East Coast. This is your 5 a.m. West Coast wake-up call in all time zones in between and around the world. Welcome into the show this Friday, October the 18th. Coming up in just a few minutes, we are going to be joined by Soccer America's Paul Kennedy to talk all kinds of different things, especially we're gonna probably dig into some stuff on the U.S. men's national team as well. A story that we've been sitting on this week is one that I wanted to get to, and we just kept running out of time on the shows, and I wanted to make it a point to lead off the show today talking about Carly Lloyd. Carly Lloyd is one of the greatest U.S. women's national team players to have ever worn the jersey. She is in the twilight of her career as she is in her late 30s. And in a recent article, talked about how this summer's World Cup role was the worst time of her life. In an interview this week with Julie Foudy, she spoke about her frustrations and in particular her diminished role on the U.S. women's national team after the 2016 Olympics and the toll the past 3 years took on her professionally and personally. Now, one of the most difficult things that you can do as an athlete, any person, is when you're coming to the end of your career and It's oftentimes difficult to deal with the realities of the fact that you're not as good as you used to be. And you may still want to contribute, may still like you feel still feel like you can contribute. And it's often a difficult thing. And it's a difficult thing on the flip side from a leadership management standpoint. How do you deal with those players who, you know, are maybe not quite in their prime, but still valuable contributors, leaders, etc.? And it's a hard thing to do, to be able to execute on that and execute well. Lloyd went on to say, "I'm not going to lie and sugarcoat it. It was absolutely the worst time of my life. It affected my relationship with my husband, friends. It really was rock bottom of my entire career. But somehow you see light at the end of the tunnel, and I can honestly say I'm having more fun now playing than I ever have in my career. I think I just learned a lot throughout it." She blamed a little bit of her troubles over the last few years with the U.S. women's national team on a badly sprained ankle suffered while playing for the Houston Dash in the NWSL in 2017. And that was right around the time that Jill Ellis was shifting to a 4-3-3 formation. She's traditionally always tried to play and enjoyed playing as an attacking midfielder. And but that generally was taking place in a different setup than what the U.S. women's national team was kind of shifting into. And she had some other comments, and some of these other comments were comments that some have deemed to be a little controversial, to be honest. They've kind of, you know, given her a little hard time about some of these comments. I think I've got a little bit different take on these, but nonetheless, these are some of the comments she said that really stood out and received some criticism. She said, "There's no denying it. I deserve to be on that field that whole World Cup, but I wasn't. And I think I've grown as a person, as a player. It sucked. It absolutely sucked. I was super happy for my teammates and happy for Megan." She was referring to Megan Rapinoe, "who put the team on her back, and for several other players. It was great to see, and I'm happy that I could still have been a part of it." She's gotten some flack for the fact that she said, "There's no denying it. I deserve to be on that field the whole World Cup, but I wasn't." And here's my take on this. Oftentimes, it's really hard for athletes to figure out when the end is the end. It's difficult to do, and sometimes you don't feel like you're at the end. Sometimes circumstances happen, like a badly sprained ankle, and you find yourself on the outside looking in of what you think or wish or hope was an opportunity, and those are all valid points. But my take on this is the mentality of Carly Lloyd in this interview is why she is one of the greatest U.S. women's national team players of all time. It is what is lacking in the U.S. men's national team. So rather than sit here and pile on like so many others have done and criticize Carly for her comments, I applaud them. Who cares? She feels that way. That's why she's so good. That's why the best are the best. There is no Cristiano Ronaldo or Leo Messi if they didn't look themselves in the mirror and go, I'm the best. I deserve to be here. That level of confidence is required to be great. As a coach and as a dad, I've always tried to teach my players or my own kids this concept. That before you can get to a place where you are unbeatable, you first have to get comfortable. If you're not comfortable, you're never going to get to a place where you can dominate. And so there's really kind of three stages that a player has to get to, and it's that final stage where Michael Jordan, Messi, and others have separated themselves from everyone else. So the first level, the first phase is you got to get comfortable. You got to get comfortable in your own skin. You got to get comfortable in your environment. You got to be comfortable with who you are, how good you are. Comfortable with the idea that you deserve to be there. If you don't believe it, no one else will. You have to get comfortable. Secondly, that comfort has to lead, and it does, it builds into confidence. You have to be certain, not just comfortable, but certain of your greatness, certain of how good you are and how good you can be. Certainty does not mean that you don't work. Certainty does not mean that you don't put in the hours that is required to become great. But it does mean that when you look yourself in the mirror, you know, you don't hope, you know that you're good. You know that you're great. And finally, it leads to a healthy level of cockiness. If you go back and watch Michael Jordan, clips of Michael Jordan, go back and watch Ronaldinho, you watch Messi, you watch Ronaldo, you watch these players, think back to the 2015 World Cup. The comment that came from Carly Lloyd, there's no denying it, I deserve to be on that field that whole World Cup, but I wasn't, is the same mentality, the same cockiness, the same confidence that is required to not only have the idea, have the audacity, but be willing to put your neck on the line to take the shot in that 2015 World Cup to beat the keeper from the center line. Moxie. instead of getting on or piling on or beating up Carly Lloyd for her comments, I think we should instead be celebrating it. We don't have enough of that moxie within U.S. soccer, especially in our national team programs on the men's side. And going forward, as players like Carly Lloyd are reaching the twilights of their career, we need the next generation of our U.S. women's national team to assume that mantle of cockiness, boldness, brashness, to step up to the plate and take their shot. I love it. I love what she said. I wish more of our players had that in them. I wish more of our coaches had that in them. Not because of delusion. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying be delusional. I'm not saying that you get there and you get lazy. I'm saying do it. Put in the work. Believe in yourself. And don't be ashamed of it. And when you do mess up, you look in the mirror and you say, look, I messed up. You look in the camera and say, I own it. It's my fault. I messed up. Whatever the case is, you own it. There's a level of accountability with yourself before anyone else. A player like that doesn't reach that level without personal accountability. You hold yourself to higher standards. You hold yourself to standards that stretch you, that force you to train, that force you to put in the hours. Because not only do you believe in yourself, you are committed to becoming the greatest version of yourself. So you get comfortable. That comfort builds into confidence. That confidence, that assuredness leads to cockiness. And when you get cocky, when you find a cocky player who has talent and who has put in the time, watch out, because they are the most dangerous player on the field. And we need more of those in American soccer. So kudos to Carly. Kudos to what she said. I don't think she should be getting any flack for it. If anything, I think she should be celebrated for speaking up, speaking her mind, and demonstrating yet again what it means to have the mentality of a champion. So I appreciate her words and her honesty and her feelings about what transpired over the last 3 years, and especially this summer. Our sponsor this half hour is DuckTick Brand. You can learn more about DuckTick Brand at DUKTIGBrand.com. Use promo code DWSHOW to get 10% off of your next order. Again, that is DWSHOW to get 10% off of your next order. We'll be right back after this with Paul Kennedy. Welcome back into the show. It is Friday, October the 18th, and we are delighted to be joined again by Paul Kennedy. Paul, welcome to the show. How are you?
Good. How are you doing there this morning?
Doing well. And we're happy to have you on the show. Wanted to first pick your brain and see what you thought of the debacle in Toronto. I don't know if that's the official title, but that's the working title for this morning. The U.S. men's national team falling to Canada for the first time in 34 years, 2-0 in Toronto. What did you see and what have you heard since?
The title that I used was Lost in Toronto, so I'm sure we got probably out there 10 to 20 different descriptions of what happened. And my point would be is that the concerning point was it wasn't just the fact that they lost to a Canadian team that obviously had a lot on the line and was very inspired, but that the U.S., they just looked lost. And, the players, when they got behind, nothing really happened. And it isn't, and after the game, Greg Berhalter said, well, they should have gotten, basically said they should have gotten stuck in more. And, I mean, to me, that's not the problem. There's never been a problem with the U.S. team about, playing hard. And so that's the part that was probably the most concerning. I think it reflects a couple of things, which is the fact that you obviously have a young team, but also you have an inexperienced coach who seems to have gone in a direction that the players have had difficulty buying into, only because what he's trying to do was really difficult. And it's also something where, as a national team coach, you don't have a lot of time with players, and to try to build a quote system, whether or not there is a system or whatever, is a very dangerous thing. It's interesting to see the reaction over the last couple of days since then, Wednesday and even yesterday, Thursday. It's amazing how people still talk about it. What I find also interesting is that even though a lot of people have said, they've lost interest in the team. They're no longer following it. Those that remain are, incredibly passionate about it and feel very strongly about it in a good way. And so from that point of view, the fact that a lot of people care is very important. I think there's a disconnect with the Federation. A lot of people say the Federation, has no connection to the fans and they don't care about the fans, and whether or not that's true or not is irrelevant, and that if that perception's out there, that's a huge problem. And the last thing is that, still people are watching the team, meaning the we had in Thursday Soccer America a look at the TV audiences for the men's and women's for August, September, and October. And on even just English language, forget the issue of Spanish language, where you have a lot of fans, and especially the men's national team still draws very well and is drawing surprisingly well, is, the men's games are more watched than the women, something that, a lot of people would find hard to believe.
When we looked at, when we look at that performance, on, Tuesday night, the biggest thing for me going into the game, and I told some people moments before the game even kicked off, if Canada wins, I will not be surprised. This was something that I don't think anyone should be shocked at the loss. There's been nothing in a matter of consistency of performances. In the last 2 years since the debacle with failing to qualify for the 2018 World Cup in October of 2017 against Trinidad and Tobago, we haven't seen substantive, what I would consider like major milestone progress. We went about a year with an interim manager in Dave Sarakin, and then the worst kept secret, I think, of all time in U.S. soccer, we announce Greg Berhalter. Greg comes in, and yet it's still kind of been blasé, kind of a malaise. There's not really been any true signs of progress. You know, even since Greg Berhalter took over, and you go into that game and you, in from the very first kickoff, you know, you just saw, you know, Canada had the ball to kick off the game and the U.S. couldn't get the ball. And when they got it, they couldn't keep it. And it just kept continuing. And, you know, I wasn't surprised. Which is the sad part of this. I wasn't surprised based on the trends that we've seen. And, you know, Canada got all that they deserved out of that match and, you know, had every reason to celebrate afterwards. And I think there's every bit of reason and justification for consternation and concern and panic and outrage by U.S. soccer fans at the state of the U.S. men's national team program. And I think you can set aside, you know, styles, right? Playing styles. If, you know, depending on the coach and the manager, maybe they have one style of play they prefer of the other. My bigger issue isn't, you know, whether Greg Berhalter fashions himself as, you know, a Pep Guardiola inspired coach who wants to play a brand of possession based soccer. Personally, that's my favorite style of play. I'm fine with that if that's what you want to do. My bigger concern is what I would call a lack of leadership, and that lack of leadership for me is showing up in a couple different ways. His comments always seem to be trying to deflect or put blame on the players or something else. That bothers me. Another aspect of the lack of leadership for me is if you are a leader, one of your jobs, one of your roles is to provide vision and teaching and being able to communicate your ideas in a way, not just where you understand them, but those who are under your coaching can hear them and understand them, process them, comprehend them. And so we're not seeing that. And then on top of it, we're not seeing this hunger and passion, this fight on the field. And, you know, I think that goes back to a culture issue within that locker room, within the team. You know, despite the words that we hear that, you know, these players are all in and blah, 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 you know, we're building something here. We're not seeing that from a process standpoint play out. I get every now and then a team's going to have a result that is just going to go against you and everything's going to go wrong. I understand that. No one is expecting any team, whether it's a U.S. men's national team or U.S. women's national team, to be perfect and win every time and win by a gazillion goals. However, we should be able to see over the course of time, if we're looking at data points, you know, trends, some positive momentum and positive growth from the way that the team is playing, whatever that style may be, and also the way the team is performing, communicating, showing that hunger and desire, you know, those kind of things. And for that reason, it makes me very concerned about the state of where this U.S. men's national team program is, because I see on a macro level a lot of issues that go beyond just, hey, I didn't get my tactics right in this one match. Are you hearing similar things from people around the country that are following this, you know, whether on or off the record, in terms of just seeing the angst about where we are as a program on a macro level?
Yes, obviously. And I think to talk about a couple of the points that you just mentioned, I think, you know, communication and leadership, you know, leadership and communication go together, and that a leader wants to communicate his vision or her vision to those that work for him, in this case, a coach and his players. And I think one of the big issues is with Greg Berhalter is fine and good, he's got this, you know, this vision. let's say it's a good one, for argument's sake. He still has to be able to communicate that to his players, and if the players aren't understanding it, it isn't necessarily the player's fault, it's the communication. And again, as a national team coach, you do not have a lot of time to work with players. And, you know, so much, so often we've heard in the last couple of games, issues related to, you know, the video the players watch. You know, if I'm a national team player who has come over from Europe and has a couple of days with a team, the last thing I want to do, and the last thing I want to do because I'm probably jet lagged, is sit and watch a lot of film. And so, you know, I think he's, you know, he's trying to, you know, he's too ambitious. Where I think a lot of national team coaches, and the example would be, say, with, I think both with Jurgen Klinsmann and Bob Bradley and Bruce Arena, the success they had was when they were a lot more practical. And, you know, obviously that's only one part of it, in that, you know, we have right now we have a thin player pool, and for however good we think these young players are, I mean, you know, 2 years on, who would have thought Christian Pulisic would be in the situation is now, you know, not even getting off the bench at Chelsea. You know, forever much, you know, everyone wants Josh Sargent to be on the field, you know, against Canada on Tuesday night. He looked lost. And so, the predicament is that it's going to take time. And, you know, unfortunately, that time is going to come to a halt when we have qualifying start for the next World Cup, which will be in less than a year.
When we look at a point that you just brought up about video, players coming in on international break and then, you know, spending time with a lot of video session teaching, with the way that technology is today, I can take a video and send it to anyone in the world in a second. Why are we not, if we have a player pool, why aren't we sending these things out ahead of time? Why are we waiting and trying to cram for the proverbial test the day before a match?
I don't know the answer to, the circumstances of what video and how often and what it's sent out, I don't know, but I'm sure players are getting stuff. Although Greg said early on in the process is that when players are with their clubs, he does not want to overload them with quote national team related stuff, because you know their first focus is going to be on their club, and he doesn't want to interfere with that, which is understandable. So I wouldn't say that they don't do that. I think, you know, Greg has said why he doesn't want to do a lot of that.
Well, when I look at something like video, for example, if it's a, you know, 3-minute clip of, hey, this is something at our next camp we're going to focus on, I'm pretty sure that in the life of a professional footballer, they can find 3 minutes to watch and hear a quick review. You know what I'm saying? Like,
I think, you know, I'm not, you know, I don't know what they're doing between camps. I think the issue is a little bit is at the camp, they're getting overloaded in ways that, you know, if you're a professional, a young professional, the danger is that they're going to get overloaded and they're going to turn off. And to me, a little bit, the issue is, the question was, and especially in the Canada game, is that they just, you know, they looked lost, and, you know, the body language wasn't great. It wasn't, say, the example would be, let's say the U.S. Costa Rica game of 2016, where the U.S. lost in San Jose 4-0, and the game cost Jurgen Klinsmann his job. The point was that game, the players, you know, they gave up that game, you know. And I don't think they gave up, but they just didn't know what to do. And that's, you know, as a coach, I would be concerned with that. And, you know, that's where there should be a lot of soul searching of how the direction of the team is based upon that.
One of the things I think when we get back to kind of communication is, you know, the ability to explain yourself in kind of simple but impactful ways, being able to reduce information down to bite-sized, bits of information that is easily processed and prime, you know, a player for action. One of the things my dad used to say to me growing up was, "Do you have something to say, or are you just saying something?" And it was his way of trying to teach me about, you know, mean what you say, come to a point, come to an idea. Don't just ramble for ramble's sake. And sometimes, you know, as coaches, if I'm putting my coaching hat on for a moment, we have a lot of ideas, a lot of things that we want to teach. Maybe it's, you know, a curriculum that includes playing out from the back, how we want to do restarts of play, free kicks, corner kicks, possession in this part of the field versus, maybe the back half of the field. Whatever the case may be, we have all these things, this kind of macro, big picture level view of our philosophy and how we want to play. The tough thing is sometimes is figuring out how much to say and in what way can we package what we're saying so that players can get it without being overwhelmed and overloaded. That seems to be a recurring theme that you keep bringing up, that you keep hearing, is this players being overloaded or overwhelmed by information.
Yeah, and I think the one thing to add there is that one of the problems the team has is among themselves, they don't have a lot of experienced players or a lot of, quote, leaders that, you know, stand out. And the point being that the communication has to, between a coach and his players, has to be two ways in that if the players aren't understanding, liking whatever the disconnect is, the leaders of the team have to go back to the coach and say, "Look, you know, we got to find a different way to do this." And I don't think that's easily done with this team because there are not a lot of leaders. Meaning, the natural leader in the team for years was Michael Bradley in a good way, but he hasn't been. You know, he's in and out of the team, and you have a player like probably the most leadership qualities among the young players is Tyler Adams, and he hasn't been in the team since March. He's been with the Thurhalter once. That's another issue, I think, that, you know, hurts the ability to progress as a team, let alone, you know, is going to be an issue when you're in games trying to solve problems among themselves.
If we zoom out a little bit from the U.S. men's national team, speaking specifically of this squad and this coaching staff, and kind of go the next layer up, and we start to look at, you know, available players, player pool, etc. One of the things that plays into that is development, the system, the structure. U.S. soccer has been, you know, married to Major League Soccer since its inception. For the last couple of decades, that has been their league of choice, their league of preferred pathway, development of players, at least until the age of 18, until they can, you know, maybe leave the shores and head to Europe if they don't have a European passport. And that has been kind of their primary vehicle for player development. When we look at our national team and we look at the player pool of available players, and we're saying the player pool is thin and we don't have enough leaders, we don't have enough mature seasoned players, at what point do questions need to start being asked of those in charge at a layer above this national team in terms of the overall picture of player development, the system, the structure, Why are we not producing more Weston McKennies, Tyler Adams, Christian Pulisics for a country this large, this many resources? We have millions of registered players within the Soccer Federation, one of the largest amounts of registered players in the world. Why are we not producing higher level players through our system so that we're not looking at, you know, a dearth of talent at the present U.S. men's national team squad and setup?
To me, it's sort of a tough question in that you could look ahead to what is coming up from down below, and the talent pool is much, much deeper and much more talented. And I would say, you know, a lot of that is the investment that's been made in the last 5 years in player development. That doesn't mean that there aren't some really huge issues to what I would say is some, not crazy, but, you know, really bad situations going on related to, say, the Federation, which has turned into, the program below the national team is producing good teams despite itself in terms of its dysfunction and in terms of its inability to staff itself. I think the issues of, and at the same time, you could say, well, you know, if the players right now at the ages of 18, 19, and 20, of which probably two-thirds of them in Europe or one-third of them are in MLS, is, you know, the deepest pool the U.S. has ever had, it still needs to be twice as deep as that to allow for the numbers game to take effect, which is, you know, for every, you know, five players that come along that have great talent, you know, the reality is that the odds are that one of them is going to make it. So you look at other countries, you know, like France, like the Netherlands right now, where they just have that many more players coming up. You know, and there you look at just the nature of the of our country, and that we say we're a soccer country, but we're really, you know, the soccer interest is very thin. And I think, you know, for all the registered players, you know, the 90% of them are playing at a very nominal level, and there's nothing wrong with that. And a lot of countries around the world, they don't register, you know, players aren't registered like that. They're registered only when they're playing on a not competitive necessarily, but an organized club. The problems that exist are quite daunting. But I remain optimistic, even though the U.S. right now looks in a difficult position, only because I would say it's night and day difference between 5 years ago and the players coming up. And there's many factors to that, you know, the development, the resources that are available, the understanding of the players, understanding of their parents and those around them of what's required is just, you know, that much better. So that these players, you know, and there's also for the first time a semblance of a pathway in a sport in a country where there's no simple or easy pathway that, you know, would exist in other American sports or in terms of soccer and other parts of the world, but you're starting to see some of that pathway in some parts of the country that are allowing players to move along a lot faster.
When we look at the men's program at large, again, a little bit above the present day recent debacle in Toronto, and look at the squad, we look at what you were just talking about this next kind of crop of players you know, that are either knocking on the door of entering the senior national team program or just behind them. One of the things that we have to keep in mind is that the men's Olympic team has failed to qualify for the last two Olympics. We have next year's Olympics right around the corner. How critical is it, with everything going on right now on the men's national team, senior team struggles that you know have not really been cured over the last 2 years, you know, as we've talked about, still kind of trying to just tread water, much less make progress. How critical is it for the men's Olympic team to qualify this, you know, for this upcoming tournament next summer? Do we find more pressure building even on the national team with a third successive failure to qualify for the Olympics?
Obviously it's you know, it would be you know really bad, and you know, you can look on paper the pool of that play of the U23s, which are mostly the last two U20 teams. You know, you even have guys like Gio Reyna on the U17s, you know, is tremendous. But the problem is a little bit, which shouldn't affect qualifying, because, again, it's CONCACAF, which, you know, again, if you can't get out of CONCACAF, you really got to wonder what's going on. The reality is that you know, there's a lot of players, but clubs releasing them is going to be dicey because they're not required to. You know, but as I said, meaning that, you know, we should be able to qualify for the Olympics with our under 23 B or C team. If not, you know, there is a problem. And, you know, it would be, you know, terrible. But again, you know, you look at something like, you know, the U20s made it to the quarterfinals in Poland, third straight time they made it to the quarterfinals. But, you know, that's where I say there's, you know, a current disconnect, a dysfunction in that, you know, that the coach of that team, Tao Ramos, you know, has been shunted, and I would imagine would be soon departing the federation, only because of lack of opportunities to move forward and is within the federation. And again, to me, it goes back to so many issues relate to the fallout from not qualifying in for the 2018 World Cup in Trinidad, in that the consequence to that was Sunil Gulati decided not to run for president again, which meant that, you know, a lot of stuff that he had done up until then was now going to be dismantled. And the example to that was, you know, Tab Ramos was obviously Sunil's guy and would have likely, I'm not sure, 100% or more than two-thirds likely, but he would have been likely to have been the national team coach after the 2018 World Cup, after Bruce Arena stepped aside. So, you know, again, you know, a lot of the issues we're talking about come back to a situation where we're dealing with a federation right now that is really letterless.
We have a rudderless federation for sure. A lot of issues. Another thing that I'm looking at, the Olympics, and then what comes next, 2022 World Cup qualifications, as well as, you know, the actual 2022 World Cup. Looking at where we are, looking at trends, I don't see this men's national team making it easy on themselves. As you mentioned, it's CONCACAF. We should be able to without too many issues, but I don't see that. I see it being a struggle, at least unless some leadership changes take place. I see that this qualification being a struggle, just like the 2018 qualification ended up being a struggle. As you kind of look ahead over the next 12, 18, 24 months, getting ready for 2022, do you see the same signs that this is going to be a grind to try to qualify on the men's side for the 2022 World Cup?
I would say, it's in some form or another, it's always been a grind. The away matches are always tough ones, but what the U.S. always had was a confidence and a swagger about themselves that they always got through it somehow. They also always benefited from the fact that at least one or two of the other key teams in CONCACAF, typically in Central America, but sometimes in the Caribbean, imploded. A lot of times it would be, because their federation was messed up and they would make impulsive coaching changes or they would always benefit from the other teams falling apart. Last time a little bit, that wasn't the case. You had Panama, coming through finally and qualifying. And the other example would be Honduras, which in another cycle would have fired their coach because of some bad results. You got to remember is they lost to the U.S. 6-0 in San Jose in Arena's first game in March of 2017. But, they held the course. How the teams are, going forward remains to be seen. The Gold Cup, the Central American teams were not very strong this time. So from that point of view, that works in the U.S.'s favor, but it can't ever be in a situation relying upon the other teams to collapsing to qualify.
So backing out of the whole men's national team setup, the Olympics, World Cup, etc., let's get to some other things. With Soccer America, what are some stories that you guys are covering that you find interesting, whatever? What's going on in Soccer America world that we need to know about?
I think some of the things that we've covered recently, a lot of them are federation-related. A lot of them are things that go to what I say is a dysfunction, the disconnect between the federation and its members, and even beyond that, not just its members, but the soccer community at large, because a lot of cases you have communities that and groups that feel left out, neglected, disenfranchised, whatever you want to refer to it. And a couple of examples would be, we wrote recently about so much was made after Carlos Cordero became president about starting a task force to look at all the issues related to youth soccer and the million things that people say they don't like about it. And it turned out that, after, I don't remember the exact time frame, but probably say a year, when it finally came out who was on the various committees, there wasn't one Latino man on any of the committees. And again, it just showed, the lack of, the lack of understanding of what's going on. And to me, it wasn't just an issue of the federation. It was the issue of the groups, meaning the organizations that are under the federation, U.S. Club, USYS, AYSO, SAY, USSSA, all these youth soccer organizations, and their own dysfunction. A lot of people look at it in the context of, say, the national teams, where you look at the youth national teams right now, and the number of Hispanic players has risen incredibly. Most of the teams are at least 50% Latino, and some of them are 80 or 90% Latino. And to me, it goes to is that a lot of these youth organizations, their concerns are not the same as even the concerns of, say, the Federation, and that they're not worried about producing players for national teams. They're worried about the little things that they're trying to do each day to move forward that are unrelated to that. And some of them are legitimate issues, such as opportunities to provide better coaching, better access to fields, better refereeing. But then a lot of them are also things like turf wars and things like that over, you know, registration and that. So that's one of the things that, you know, we've been working on. And the other one recently was the whole issue of the Women's World Cup, FIFA coming in and in a good way, starting a program to give money back to teams, whether it's a pro team or the youth teams that a player played on, and compensating them. In the same way, obviously much more modest in scope, what they do with the men's clubs around the world, which is sort of, in that situation, paying them off or, allowing them to be released. And it turned out the Federation never let the youth clubs know what was going on. And the issue has since been resolved, since we wrote about the story. But what it goes to me, is the fact that the Federation is so overwhelmed by any number of issues that, couldn't let their members know that, you know, this thing's out there, and even if it's not a matter of knowing the exact process or the way it's going to work, to at least let them know what's going on. So to me, that one is as much symptomatic of the issues going on in Chicago right now that are unresolved.
So when we look at the myriad of issues, obviously it goes beyond the U.S. national team losing in Toronto to Canada. It's even bigger. Where there's smoke, there's fire. When we really dig in, as you guys have done with some of your coverage, we find that these issues, they're ongoing. They go beyond just, an isolated incident. It's not one thing. It's a collection of things. And it's in and through that lens that we see, these things pile up as systemic, as systematic structural problems, whether that's, administrative processes, et cetera. And in light of that, a lot of the speculation has been, that the Federation, they had basically held the head coaching spot for Greg Berhalter. His brother is the COO of U.S. Soccer. Another rumor, and there's been a lot of consternation over this, a lot of reviews with Glassdoor about, the culture within U.S. Soccer, that Jay Berhalter covets that CEO position, that he wants it. Are you hearing anything in regards to that? I mean, if he is the COO and we're having all of these administrative issues, how does the Federation and the board even look internally for solutions? Why would we not be trying to look outside if we are continually running into issue after issue, which has also resulted in lawsuit after lawsuit, et cetera? Are you hearing anything on the CEO search?
What we've heard is that they, that the Glassdoor reviews put a stop to the process that was in place, which would have likely led to Jay Berhalter's selection as the next CEO. They are in the process of starting a new search and starting from scratch. I would imagine, I'll put it this way. It's on everybody who works at the Federation or is on a board or is involved in the Federation is that, they act like these Glassdoor reviews were a surprise. You know, they recognize that they're the reality, but you know, any organization should recognize that when you got a problem, you know, it might not be able to fix it. You might not be able to, fix it right away, but you should at least recognize it. And that to me is the most concerning thing is they acted like, you know, they didn't know it, but they recognize now what the problem is. And, I would be shocked if Jay Berhalter got the job. I would be shocked. And, that would go to the fact that when Dan Flynn left, that Brian Remedy was given the, I don't think interim position of CEO, but he was named chief administrative officer, a title he actually used to have, which makes him the sort of highest ranking officer of the Federation right now, above Jay Berhalter. Still, the issue is to find someone from the outside who would want the job. And I have written about it before, is that that's the biggest issue. I've been told that the search was down to, in June, was down to three people, Berhalter, Brian Remedy, and a television executive. I would imagine now they're going to look at a much wider search. You know, I know people who have been contacted about it, asking whether they're interested in, would be interested in the position. But the reality is that the Federation, to take the job is a no-win situation, and that, it's so complex and it's such a daunting, position on a good day. But that, on top of that, you have all the lawsuits which have really make it so that if you're an ambitious executive and are offered an opportunity to, quote, turn around a company, you'll find that attractive. But the point is that you want to be able to dictate what is done. And in this case, because of all the lawsuits, the lawyers are running the show. And that's the problem. I mean, I would say that, each of the lawsuits individually, there are cases to be made on the Federation side, and some of them are actually very sympathetic to their position. But when you add them all collectively, it's a nightmare. And, I don't see how they're going to be able to extract themselves from the legal situation they're in, and we'll be in, say, next year, where everything will be dominated by any number of lawsuits, whether it's the NASL suit, the women's suit, the Hope Solo suit. You have the relevant case, which, again, came up in the last 24 hours with La Liga, proposing to play another game in Miami. So, if you're a CEO wanting to take that position at the Federation, it would be, hard to find good people.
Last question on all of this for today, at least. I mean, we could go 4 hours, I think, on a variety of topics and still barely scratch the surface. When we look at all of the, changes, the task force, the leadership problems, culture issues we're seeing within the Federation. How important is it, do you think, for U.S. soccer to adopt some form of the Rooney Rule when it comes to hiring, task force, committees, etc.?
I think it's essential. Meaning, I'm not sure what form that would take, but you know, it would be, it would go a long ways towards opening things up, put it that way. Meaning that right now, you know, if you just look within who you know is just like you, and who you know is a same limited group of bodies within the Federation, which, and by that meaning that, you know, you look at the task force that we talked about, who did they hire? All the people that they knew who worked at state associations or within the national organizations of the youth organizations. And that's just not good enough. And it's, you know, the thing about the, a quote Rooney rule is that, you know, there's the benefit there of looking at, a diverse group within the body of athletes and coaches and administrators that exist to make sure that that diversity is examined. And you know, you look at the Federation, you go to the AGM, and the makeup of that body is doesn't reflect our soccer country, let alone our country.
Yeah, I agree. The more I think about it, the more, you know, I've been around the Federation at a national level with national councils, et cetera, and you look through, you know, who is in what positions where, I think that these type of changes are going to have to be intentional policy changes in order for us to change the culture. We do have a culture problem. I do think it needs to get changed, and I do think it's going to require some policy changes in order for us to get there in the future. Paul, I appreciate you coming on the show, and thankful that we had a chance to connect again. How can people follow your work and read Soccer America and get it delivered into their mailbox, you know, each and every day?
You can subscribe to Soccer America. You can go to SoccerAmerica.com and sign up. We have various offers on there. And you can also follow me on Twitter at PKEdit. So I look forward for everyone to follow what we do.
Well, Paul, thanks for coming on the show. We really appreciate your time. Good luck with Soccer America. Look forward to seeing some more of the stories that you are covering. And hopefully next time when you're on, it won't be so much bad news. But when we look at all the lawsuits and everything else going on, I don't know if we're going to be positivity land anytime soon. We just got so many issues to fix. But thank you for your work and your coverage of the sport. We know you've been around a while and you've been faithful to keep covering the sport. So thanks for all your work and good luck with Soccer America. We look forward to having you back on again soon.
Thank you, and I'd love to be on soon again. I enjoy it.
Thank you. That is Paul Kennedy. Appreciate him joining the show this morning. We'll be right back after this.
No one, no man, no woman, no child should ever have to drink green water with bugs, with algae, with disease in it. Bad water and a lack of toilets kills more people than all the wars in the world. We know how to bring clean drinking water right now to every single person on earth. And when you can bring water into communities, it truly transforms them. It changes everything. Right? You could know that you'd made a difference. You could know that you had truly impacted the life of a family, of a community, of a region. There was either clean water or there wasn't. We believe in a world where every single person has clean and safe water to drink, and we will continue fighting until that happens. Thank you.
thanks to Paul for joining us on the show today. I really appreciate him dropping in and having a good chat with us about all things U.S. soccer, U.S. men's national team, landscape overall, the federation. There's just so many places to go and have a discussion. Look forward to having him back on again real soon. Thanks for watching. As always, you can watch on facebook.com/WRKMN or at danielworkman.com. You can also find me on Twitter or Instagram @DanielWorkman. Thanks for watching. We'll see everyone again next week. We'll